This webcast is a service of SDPB. More information at sd.net.
You may be seated. Thank you. Well, what a great crowd. We appreciate everybody being here this morning. I want to thank Dean Fulton and the law school for rolling out the red carpet for the court this week as we hear some cases the next 2 days. We appreciate the great attendance from law students. We also have students from Morningside College here and from Mount Marty College in the auditorium as well. We appreciate your attendance as well. We have four cases set for argument this morning. The first case set for argument is Andrew Morris et al. Versus the State of South Dakota, appeal number 30899. Arguing on behalf of the plaintiff and appellants will be Matthew Learberg and Matthew Hughes. I understand Mr. Learberg, you'll be doing 5-minute rebuttal, and then Mr. Hughes will do opening.
Yes, sir.
All right. And then we also have at council table Steve Beardsley. For the defendant appellees, Tara Larson will be arguing, and then we also have present Robert Anderson and Robert Morris. Each side will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and then plaintiff appellants will have a 5-minute rebuttal. With that, Mr. Learberg, you may proceed with your argument.
Mr. Chief Justice, Your Honors, Counsel, may it please the court, Matthew Hughes on behalf of plaintiffs. This court should reverse the grant of summary judgment to the state on sovereign immunity and should grant summary judgment to plaintiffs on liability because plaintiffs have pled and proved beyond genuine dispute their claim for inverse condemnation, a claim to which the defense of sovereign immunity simply does not apply. Before turning to inverse condemnation, I'll address sovereign immunity briefly. It's controlled by this court's decisions in Rupert and the majority decision in Long.
So do we even need to really spend a lot of time on sovereign immunity? Isn't really the question really here. The only claim you've pled is inverse condemnation. If you've got inverse condemnation claim, there's no sovereign immunity. So, I mean, don't you just go right to inverse condemnation?
Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly right. The state conceded this in their brief, that their whole sovereign immunity argument is just a different way of trying to say that we haven't pled and proved a claim for inverse condemnation. So unless the court has specific questions on sovereign immunity, which we believe is a clear-cut case and demands reversal because the circuit court expressly relied on the dissent in Long, I'll proceed directly to inverse condemnation and address those issues.
And you're taking theory as part of that?
Yes, Your Honor. And I just want to take a moment to explain that we have both a taking theory and a damages theory. So we believe that the common law is quite clear that surface owners have the right to subjacent support, and all property owners have the right to lateral support. And the state has deprived plaintiffs of those rights, the rights to subjacent and lateral support. That's our taking theory. Those property rights have been taken. Our damaging theory is very, very simple, that the state's failure to fulfill its duties of subjacent and lateral support have resulted in severe damage to the surface estates. So there's taking, there's damaging. Either way you want to look at it, there is a taking or a damaging under the South Dakota State Constitution.
Into which category do your strict liability claims fall?
Both.
Okay.
Because strict liability really is, it really is a result of the common law property rules that are at issue. The common law of South Dakota, as explained in the Ulrich case from about a century ago, is that regardless of care or skill or ordinary care, if lateral support or subjacent support is deprived, there is liability, period. There's no question of the use of reasonable care. And many of this court hasn't had the occasion to address that in the subjacent support context, but every other state applies the same strict liability.
Do you have to win on strict liability in order to win in the appeal? In other words, can you make out a causation claim on your damage theory in the absence of winning on strict liability?
We certainly can, Your Honor.
And as a matter of law?
As a matter of law. At most, there's a genuine dispute of material fact that should be remanded for a bench trial. But we don't think that it should even go to a bench trial on liability. And just to be clear, the procedural posture is summary judgment was granted to the state on sovereign immunity. We believe that should be reversed full stop, period. We're also asking for affirmative summary judgment as to liability as a matter of law. We think we win because the undisputed, unrebutted expert testimony says that the cause of the subsidence and the collapse in Hideaway Hills is the state's infusion of gypsum backfill into this property. That went unrebutted by any expert testimony by the other side. And they admitted in their summary judgment briefing below that for the purposes of this motion, this backfill is everywhere we claim that it is. So they've essentially conceded that the backfill is everywhere that we say it is. And we say it's under every place that the state mined. And then there's a few places, there's a map in our brief that explains that there's a few houses of class members that would be subject to a lateral support theory as opposed to a subjacent support theory.
How does your strict liability theory map onto the text of Section 13, Article 6? In other words, the text says private property shall not be taken for public use or damaged. Doesn't the text suggest a causation component?
Certainly does, but strict liability always contains a causation component. The connotation of strict liability is just that there's no intent requirement, right? Strict liability always entails some sort of cause. It's about a mental state. There's no negligence required, no intent required for strict liability. And it's not necessarily in
but
the
you still te- got you've still got a causation requirement, and I want to understand your argument on that. Obviously the state has raised causation issues and says here, hey, there's, you know, normally that's a fact question, goes to the jury. Their argument is this is sovereign immunity. You don't present that to a jury. You just look at it as a court and make that decision as a matter of law. What do you think about that?
Sovereign immunity would be an issue of law for the court. And, of course, causation would be a matter for a bench trial.
And I'll just tell you, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but I'm not aware of any cases where we've sent questions of sovereign immunity to a jury. Those have always been resolved as a matter of law, normally pretrial, either a motion to dismiss or a motion for summary judgment. So, can, you know, I agree, proximate cause is usually a jury question, but does it bring it, because it's the issue of, you know, almost really jurisdictional, is it a situation where we just have to decide this as a matter of law, regardless of, you know, maybe there's disputed facts, maybe there isn't, we just have to decide it when it's proximate cause on a sovereign immunity issue?
If I understand your question correctly, you're asking if the proximate cause issue and the sovereign immunity issue are so intertwined that they have to rise or fall together?
Right.
I don't think so, Your Honor, because sovereign immunity is a very doctrinal issue. Long and Rupert were very clear. Sovereign immunity only applies to tort claims. It cannot apply to an inverse condemnation claim. Long specifically said, quote, this is a very close to a verbatim quote, because there are no tort claims pending, the doctrine of sovereign immunity does not apply. And in Long, what happened was exactly what happened here. Plaintiffs originally raised inverse condemnation claims and tort claims side by side. Then before this court, the tort claims had been dropped and only the inverse condemnation claim proceeded.
And the difference, as you would formulate them, isn't sometimes so much the wrong. It is in large part whether you're undertaking a public use or not, yes or no?
Well, the whether or not there's a taking or a damaging is frequently used to encompass all the elements of inverse condemnation, but there has to be a deprivation of a property right or damage to property.
Which could look like a tort or not, right?
It could look like a tort.
Correct. And so that's why, among the other sorts of tort-looking things like causation or things like that, One distinguishing factor between the two would be undertaking that for a public use, perhaps, under an inverse condemnation theory.
Yes,
whether
Your
it's
Honor.
Damages or taking.
But, you know, you could imagine a case where an inverse condemnation claim, where there is a true public use and activity by the government, could also support a tort theory of recovery if the actor happened to be a private actor. This is where the Creer versus Del Rapids Township case and the Hyde versus Minnesota Dakota and Pacific Railway case come into play. Because you had, in the latter case, you had a private entity with delegated eminent domain power against whom a sovereign, an inverse condemnation claim could be raised, but because it was a private entity, you could raise a tort claim too. Sovereign immunity just didn't apply there, and the tort theory of recovery and the inverse condemnation theory of recovery could survive side by side. In the Creer versus Del Rapids Township case, I believe there was a question as to whether or not the government entity had waived sovereign immunity by the purchase of insurance or participation in a risk-sharing pool. But that just illustrates, again, the doctrinal nature of the defense of sovereign immunity and the fact that the same facts could support a tort theory of recovery or an inverse condemnation theory of recovery, and it would be extremely confusing and problematic to try to adopt the state's "is it really a tort" test, which, in fact, we contend no state has truly adopted. The cases they cite are cases that, going back to your question, Justice Salter, really revolve around the definition of public use.
Do we have that component in this case and in this appeal?
We definitely do, Your Honor, just for a couple of reasons. Number one, the state admits in their brief that Long and Rupert were cases where the damage that was inflicted was just incidental to a public function. We at least have that here. So we have the cement plant, which was operated by the state, which the state profited from immensely. Those funds are still used to fund education in this state. We have a situation where the reclamation process, which is where we contend all of the state's, all of the problems that are occurring in Hideaway Hills today originates from, that reclamation was for the purpose of selling the surface for money so that the state could get money and recoup some of its expenditure for the land. The state tries to say that it lost money on the sale, but you have to remember it purchased the entire estate and only sold the surface. So it still probably actually profited with respect to just the surface.
Is there an issue with superseding causation here? We have other subsequent purchasers who have also issued disclaimers. Can you address that?
Yes, Your Honor. The cause of the subsidence is not what any developer did or what any developer did or did not disclose or what any realtor did or does not disclose. The sole cause of the subsidence and the collapse is the state's use of problematic backfill. And I want to take just a second to emphasize the state will probably draw attention to the underground tunnel mine that existed before the state ever got to the property. But it's important to remember the unrebutted expert testimony shows that mine was essentially hermetically sealed. It would not have collapsed if the state hadn't come in and blasted that open and then used this problematic backfill to try to plug the hole. That allowed various water and other environmental factors to start wearing down the gypsum in that mine. If the state hadn't blasted it open, you know, this sinkhole never would have happened.
Counsel, can you address, so for your takings theory, and this is your subjacent, removal of subjacent support or that you outlined here, the one thing that does seem a little different about this case compared to Long and Rupert, the taking on that deals with your argument is a piece of property that the state acquired and then for mining and did that and paid compensation at that time for that taking. So how is that different scenario still fit how we have defined a taking and who is entitled to compensation subsequent to that?
Well, Justice Devaney, I think what you're asking about is whether or not the owners were compensated for the damage. I think that's what your question is getting at. If I understand you correctly, I just want to point out this case is very different from Hanaher in a number of ways. It's not Hanaher was a negligence case. This is an inverse condemnation case. But also the central fact to remember is the state bought all this land from Ed Stensis, and then it sold the surface to Larry Fuss. When it sold the surface to Larry Fuss, it did not retain a right to continue damaging the surface estate. So, yes, the state compensated Ed Stensis when it bought the property, but as soon as it sold the surface, it would have had to compensate the surface owners for any damage it thereafter inflicted on the surface.
But aren't you alleging that the damaging or the acts of damaging occurred while the state owned both the surface and the subsurface? So what acts did the state take after the sale?
Well, Your Honor,
would be the continuing damage.
Our theory is that the state has an ongoing duty all the way up to today to provide subjacent and lateral support. And it's that omission today that renders the state liable. Yes, the state was an actor in withdrawing the subjacent support and lateral support. That's an important factor. But it's also important to remember that every day, every time there's settlement, every time there's subsidence, every time there's further collapse, that's a result of the state's right now, ongoing, today, failure to provide the subjacent support that it's required to do. So it's the state's continued activity or inactivity that we contend renders it liable in large part, not just what it did back in 1992. In my last few moments, I just want to say that this case falls exactly within Long and Rupert. Every which way you look at this case is like Long and it's like Rupert, especially Long. This court cannot rule for the state without overturning Long. And I see my time has expired. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Hughes. Ms. Larson, you may proceed with your argument.
Well, I think we've set a record today for the tallest appellant and the shortest appellee. May it please the court, counsel, Chief Justice, justices. This case is far more straightforward than appellants would have us believe. Throughout their oral argument and throughout their briefing, they are attempting to substitute tort liability theory while ignoring the elements of an inverse condemnation cause of action. And that's what the circuit court found. The circuit court ultimately found that appellants did not meet the elements of an inverse condemnation. Accordingly, the only thing that was left over were the tort causes of action, which they found based on sovereign immunity. My oral argument is going to proceed accordingly. It's going to discuss the elements of inverse condemnation, the fact that appellant's case does not meet those elements, and then it's going to go into a little further discussion of Judge Strawn's opinion, discussing and explaining how, in fact, his opinion absolutely does jive with Long. It absolutely does work with Rupert because, again, this case is not a case of inverse condemnation. Article 6, Section 13 of the South Dakota Constitution states that private property shall not be taken for public use or damaged without just compensation. Ignoring the dangling participle there, you have a private property taken or damaged for public use. That's your prima facie case for inverse condemnation. Appellants have just admitted today that all of the damage that occurred when the state owned its property. Therefore, it was not private property. It's important to remember that the state paid money for this property. It paid for the right to perform surface mining and reclaim it to the pasture ground that it had always been. When it sold that property, it sold it for approximately $50,000 less than it had purchased the property for, two people who absolutely knew that the state had mined it for gypsum and that there had been surface mining, and then who ultimately found out that there was also an underground mine there. Now, it's important to note when you at their argument and this reservation of mineral rights argument and this alleged continuing duty, which again is a tort liability theory and not within the elements of an inverse condemnation, that even if they satisfied that first element of a taking or damaging of private property, that cause of action per Johns, as it cited Palazzolo, stated that that cause of action does not pass on to subsequent purchasers. Larry Fuss was absolutely aware of the damage, the alleged damage that was performed by the cement plant in this case. He told Meade County as much when he went up there to Meade County, asked to do a residential development,
I'm sorry to interrupt, but that's a temporal argument. You know, that's sort of fixed in time. But as I understand the argument, there's a contemporaneous sort of element that plaintiffs are arguing that exists here now today. We heard about it actually just a few moments ago, either under the taking theory, but maybe more connected to the damage theory. I'm not sure. But in any event, there is a contemporaneous component to this argument. It seems right that the state can't take its own property, right? And it has to have private property. That makes sense, of course. But what about that argument that, hey, there's a contemporaneous component to this. There's a present day resonance to this. What do you say?
With regard to that, I mean, a Long example is a very good example in Long, that there can be theoretically continuous flooding, right? But it originates when, per their argument, I'm not saying this is actually the law, because the law says that the cause of action accrues when the damage is done. They admitted that the damage is done when the state, but even taking their argument, it occurs when theoretically there's a knowledge component and a person in the chain of title of all of these property owners had that knowledge. They had that knowledge at the very beginning. Instead of suing the state after they found out about this underground mine, they proceeded to develop it and disclose it.
So what does the knowledge matter, though? That's my question. Is that get out of causation? Or, you know, Justice Kern asked a question about, you know, whether there's another cause that has slipped in here. Is that what you're driving at? Help me kind of put what your knowledge argument is in the context of the
again
elements we're talking about.
Sorry, Justice. Again, that is not, it actually has to do with a ripening, but it also has to do with when a cause of action cannot be passed on to subsequent purchasers. I will tell you that that's not our argument, because the general rule and the Palazzolo example that they had used actually comes from a regulatory taking, which is completely an opposite. But I was saying for the purpose of argument that though all other people are subsequent purchasers, because Larry Fuss had knowledge, and frankly, Keith Kuchenbecker had knowledge. He fell into the underground mine. He fell into a 50-foot hole that was so deep, he had to rappel down it so long that he couldn't see the end of it. Did he sue the state then? No. He threw dirt into it and disclosed it. Then he disclosed it to the home builders, who were the ones who fraudulently concealed it to all people that would be living there. Not only does that cause of action not pass on to subsequent purchasers, but that is a superseding cause under Braun. If you read the analysis in Braun, it absolutely fits as a superseding cause. When a third person fully discovers the danger and then proceeds in deliberate disregard of it to inflict upon the plaintiff the danger in which the third person has discovered, the responsibility is shifted to that third party. It was undisputed in the lower court, and appellants did not dispute that these people had full awareness of what had occurred prior to them purchasing the property and then fraudulently disclosed.
So the argument, though, and so two things. One, I think if it is a superseding cause, and there's probably maybe a torts professor in here somewhere who could correct me, but a superseding cause, right, contemplates an existing cause. It supersedes that. And I don't know if you're just saying, hey, even if there is one or there was one and this superseded it. Curious about that. But the second thing is that I still really want to kind of lock in on this idea that the state, as the owner of the subsurface estate, has a continuing obligation under the law to not take or damage private property on the surface.
That is a tort theory. That is not inverse condemnation theory. Under inverse condemnation theory, again, they are attempting to interpose.
What distinguishes those two for our discussion?
You need to meet the requisite elements of inverse condemnation to move forward. And that's
what's missing.
We are missing the public use. We are missing the taking of private property. And that actually helps me transition into my public use argument. So thank you. With regard to the public use, the state's mining of gypsum, which is a very, very small component of 4%, that is, of cement that is sold throughout the nation, is not a public use. It may very well be a public benefit. It may very well be a public necessity. But under Illinois Central, just because something is a public purpose, just because something is a public necessity, just because it has eminent domain powers, does not mean it is used by the public. South Dakota follows the use by the public standard, and that's under Illinois Central as well. And that's use or right of use on the part of the public or some limited portion thereof. There is no public use as to the state's mining, which is, as appellants claim, the actual damage in this matter. Now, taking that one step further and the reservation.
What's the public use for putting de-icer down on the roads of Rapid City?
Maintenance of a public road.
Okay. What about executing a public necessity of mining and taking and undertaking action to not only mine, but then reclaim the area that was previously the surface mine? Is that not a public use?
That is not a public use at all under our use by the public standard. This is a very good example. The Haman case is a good example of that, right? When you have a police officer who's chasing a fleeing felon and damages property, that may very well be a public necessity. That may very well be a public purpose, but that is not use by the public. Now, moving into their arguments with regard to reservation of mineral rights in this matter, there is absolutely no use by the public when we have reserved mineral rights. So that eliminates their ongoing and continuing duty argument altogether. When we reserve mineral rights, we're constitutionally required to. And if, as they talked about, we had this ongoing duty to provide subjacent support, then that wouldn't be a public use. That would be a public detriment to the benefit of the few. I think it's important that a reservation of mineral rights does not mean that the public can go in and dig gypsum on that property. It does not mean that the public can go into the basement. There is no public use. And that is how Judge Strawn got there. Judge Strawn went, well, it doesn't satisfy the, you know, taking of private property for the purpose of public use. They're really taking tort theory and disguising it as inverse condemnation, which fully complies with, or which fully can be read in conjunction with Long and Rupert.
It appeared to me that he simply found the dissent in Long more compelling and said so and elected to follow it in that way. And that's why there's a decent argument, certainly, that he erred in his summary or his determination that sovereign immunity applies here.
Well, I think it's important to note that this court shall affirm summary judgment if it has any legal basis to do so. And if this court doesn't necessarily read Judge Strawn's opinion the way that we read his opinion, and we read his opinion as it does not satisfy inverse condemnation, and therefore it's really a tort, and that's kind of what he stated, that doesn't mean that it can't be read in conjunction with Long. Because in Long, in Long and Rupert, you have essentially a textbook inverse condemnation action. You have private property damaged pursuant to, or for a public use. That use is a road. We don't have that here. They have not satisfied those elements. The Rupert case actually was a really good example of how, yep, both a tort and an inverse condemnation can exist at the same time, but hey, tort is subject to sovereign immunity, and so therefore the court affirmed the grant of sovereign immunity for the tort, but found that they had met the requisite elements of inverse condemnation. Here, they do not meet those requisite elements of inverse condemnation.
That's my question. So if you lose on the theory that the circuit court elected to use and sort of cascading down to a tort theory that's precluded by summary judgment, if you lose on that, can you still win on appeal?
We do still win on appeal because, again, the appellants have not set forth a cause of action for inverse condemnation for the very reasons that I set forth here
today.
And
that's turning on your public use distinction that you were driving at earlier?
Yes, as well as the fact that the state cannot take from itself, and the actions and the damage, as they just admitted here, occurred when the state owned the property. It had paid for the right to do that.
How about the argument on causation? The argument in the briefs and even here today is that it's undisputed that the causation for the subsidence is attributable to pulverized gypsum and some improper fill or something like that.
So causation is a subset, but if you haven't met the necessary elements, period, causation doesn't matter because
that is a tort.
No, I understand
that, but is that right?
That is absolutely incorrect, as a matter of fact, and it's very interesting that they would argue that their experts undisputedly stated that the
does the state dispute it? That's what I want to know.
The state definitely does, and their own experts specifically said, and it's on record 5, page 204, which they allege we incorrectly cited, but we did not. They specifically said that the underground mine would have collapsed with or without the state's mining. It's on page 204 of record 5. On that same page, they stated there is no evidence whatsoever that the state performed underground mining.
And so that brings us back to pasture land and rangeland. And so the property was reclaimed for pasture land, arranged land, and then we have a subdivision built on top. And what effect does that have in the causation argument?
That's a foreseeability aspect, and again, that's only if you find that the requisite elements of inverse condemnation are met, because you don't even need to get to causation at that point. But when it comes to causation, that goes to foreseeability. And even looking forward, there is no evidence, there is nothing foreseeable about what occurred. The fact that the appraisal of the property specifically stated that this couldn't be a residential purpose or be a residential development precludes any type of foreseeability argument. And then you also have as a matter of law, superseding cause with regard to those home builders, who fraudulently concealed. And that was not disputed by appellants in this matter. I am very close to out of time.
Well, I've got a question for you before you run out of time. I'm going to go back to public use and talk about that. So our public use cases, we've said when it's a, and you're okay on time.
He controlled it.
Understood.
Our cases talk about the fact that if it's exercise of police power, we don't have an inverse condemnation claim. Other cases, though, this looks more proprietary, what the state's doing with the cement plant. No question about that. But it's a state action. It's a state use. Arguably, it has some public use. So we're clearly outside the realm of police power here. You agree with that?
I would agree with that.
So if the state's involved, and even though it looks a little bit proprietary, why is that not still public use, even though, because there's got to be some benefit, otherwise the state wouldn't be involved. I mean, why is the state doing it unless there's some public benefit, even if it is proprietary?
Certainly. So two aspects of that question. Now, the first aspect of the question, the Hayman case actually inciting with approval, the Supreme Court of Oklahoma, and I apologize, I can't remember that case citation, but in the Hayman case or Haman case, when they further described a public use, which that was, yes, a police power case, and we're not suggesting this is a police power case, we're just suggesting that it's akin to a police power, in that, you know, you look at the same use for the public analysis. But that Oklahoma case said, when you look for a public use, you're really looking for a public work. You're looking for a road. You're looking for a utility line. You're looking for a drainage thing.
Well, governmental entities condemn property for shopping malls.
Correct, Your Honor. But again, this is, that goes back to the Illinois Central case, which is still good law, which specifically says just because something is a public benefit, dare say it a public necessity, dare say it has the opportunity to impose eminent domain on something, does not mean that it is a public use. That follows the use by the public standards set forth therein. Thank you.
I have one quick
Yeah, we've got one more question.
Just one quick one. What significance... Well, is there any significance to you concerning the text of Section 13 that says private property shall not be taken for public use or damaged? Does that suggest or connote a causation element in your view? In other words, in the exercise of its conduct for a public use, the government conduct cannot cause a taking or cause damage, or am I reading too much into that?
It does go into the damages aspect, Your Honor.
Is there a causation component to the text?
Absolutely. There's a causation component to the text, but that's once you've met the prima facie case, and appellants have not met the prima facie case.
Okay.
I have one last question, if I could. So I've read the cases out of coal country where we have underground mining, and then there have been sales of the property to subsequent purchasers. Then the underground mines collapse. And courts have found liability for the actor who withdrew the subjacent support. Why shouldn't the same type of theory apply to surface mining activity, which is what we have here, and allegedly failed reclamation?
I actually will say that is accurate in the fact that Dakota Plaster, now GUS Gypsum, was the person was the company that withdrew that subjacent support with regard to the underground mine. And there is absolutely still a cause of action against them. There's also still a cause of action against the home builders who fraudulently concealed it for the rest of the properties that are not under the underground mine.
So the question was about why shouldn't that same theory of responsibility apply to surface mining activities and failed reclamation?
Because in this case, appellants have not satisfied a prima facie case for inverse condemnation. You cannot substitute tort liability theory for inverse condemnation theory. If they have not met the requisite elements like they have not here, there can be no recovery. It would be subject to sovereign immunity because that is a common law tort that has not been waived.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. Mr. Learberg, you may proceed with your rebuttal. I think a rebuttal argument is even a little taller yet. Right?
I want to use up my whole 5 minutes moving the lectern. Mr. Chief Justice, Your Honors, Counsel, may it please the Court, Matt Learberg appearing today for the plaintiffs. The state concedes again today in oral argument, just as they did in their briefs, that this is no longer a case about sovereign immunity. It's a case about the elements of inverse condemnation. That alone is enough for this court to reverse. This court could, if it so chose, just reverse on that ground and remand for further proceedings. But as the state notes and as we've noted in our
briefs... What would the further proceedings be? To do what? To nail down what in a subsequent... These are decisions that a court makes... So could have a court trial on taking damage, right? So what would be the justification? Because we could, even if a judge got that wrong, we can affirm for any basis in the record, even if it's not the same basis, of course, and you know that. So what would be the justification for reversing and sending back down? I know that's not what you want, but in that scenario, alternatively, what would that possibly look like?
Justice Holter, you're exactly right. This record is complete. The summary judgment record is before this court. There are legal issues, and the legal issue is, have we shown at summary judgment an absence of material fact as to our inverse condemnation claim? We have. The proper remand is a trial for damages. But if this court were to just reverse, just only cover sovereign immunity in reverse, then the questions of whether or not the legal test for inverse condemnation
depends what you lose on. I know, right?
The circuit court would have to do that in the first instance. But again, I think both parties today, one thing we do agree on is that this court can and should go ahead and find, assess the question of whether inverse condemnation and those elements have been met. The state said a couple of times during their presentation that we have conceded that all of the damage occurred when the state owned the property. We do not concede that. I think as some of the questions noted, this is a question of the state's obligations all throughout its ownership and continued ownership of the subservient mineral estate to this day. The state raised the question of Mr. Kuchenbacher, a previous owner, finding some hint that there might be problems at the, on the property. That is true. Mr. Kuchenbacher then went to the state and asked. And what the state told him is telling. The state said, we reclaimed the land. It's safe. And that is not true. It is not safe because there's pulverized gypsum underneath, because the state blasted open the sealed mine. And for those reasons and others, this neighborhood is now sinking. It's subsiding. It's collapsing.
So if the state didn't presently own the subsurface ground, the mineral rights, this case look different?
I think it would be a tougher case.
How it would look different.
It would be a closer case, Your Honor. And one of the reasons is, you know, it starts then to bleed into these questions of, well, when's the statute of limitations start running? What kinds of notice were in place? When was the damage actually occurring? I think because the state continues to own the subservient estate, it kind of, this case bleeds into Justice Salter's questions about
causation. Does it look different on the issues of causation?
It could. It could, Your Honor. And I think this is a point I wanted to make with respect to several of the questions, and that is this causation question. Causation does play a role. The best place for causation in a case like this is at the damages trial, right? I mean, at some point, hopefully, we will be before a jury, and we will get to show that these clients are suffering and that they can't live in their homes anymore and that it's the state's actions, both in the past and the present, that have caused that.
And so a jury, you're using damages as amount of damages, not the existence of damages in that argument. Yes,
that's right. That's right. And I concede that we do have, you know, as an element, we have shown that there is causation. The sole evidence of record is our expert report showing that it is the state's activity that has caused it. And that's at record volume 4, page 4246. Our expert says settlement of the fill is inherent of the fill section itself and has occurred and will continue to occur, and this is critical, regardless of land use or occupancy by structures or infrastructure. So this is not a case where it's the added weight of the houses that tilted things over the edge. In fact, the sinkhole that started this in 2020 was not under a house, right? It was on East Davy Drive itself.
Got a quick question. Go ahead. I'm sorry. So you have this continuing theory, this theory that there's a continuing failure to support. What is it that the state would do to avoid being responsible for a taking? What would they do now?
Right. So what the state did wrong, first, by blasting open the mine, they undermined that section of the neighborhood. By putting pulverized gypsum under the neighborhood, it was just a matter of time before rainwater would get down, dissolve that gypsum, and the neighborhood would start sinking.
So that's how they got to the problem. How would they avoid it at any point from then till now? How would they avoid the taking that you're alleging?
Well, the truth is the state has created quite a mess because now there's houses on top of that pulverized gypsum. There is no easy way for the state to go in and fix the problem now. Probably the most just result would be for the state to buy back the land and fix it.
So what's the contemporaneous failure? What is it that they have failed to do now that is continuing to be the taking?
Right. So this is just like the salmon case where if there used to be appropriate subservient or subjacent support, that obligation of the later owner that destroys that, for example, the pillars or the dirt that was there earlier, that owner has a present day obligation. And the state has violated that every single day. The state continues to violate it by not going in and trying to shore it up to the extent they can. And if they can't, they would need to repurchase.
You're not seeking injunctive relief, though. You're seeking damages.
Yes, Your Honor. And I see my time's expired, but answer your questions.
And you can, if there are other questions, you can answer those questions. Do we have other questions?
One question just in terms of the lay of the land. I was kind of trying to figure out those maps, and I'll confess I was maybe not doing great. But so is there complete, I know you've got this adjacent theory, not just the subjacent theory. Is that what kind of unites the whole community and the whole development, or are there portions of this, because we're painting with kind of a broad brush, and you know the whole community is affected, and maybe it is, but I couldn't really tell whether it was or it wasn't. Is it fair to paint with that broad of a brush, or does a court either here as a matter of law or at a trial have to lock in on specific homes, specific areas, and really figure out on a maybe lot by lot basis or area by area basis, distinct taking or damage outcomes?
Two answers to that, Justice Sulter. First, this class has been certified. The question of whether that was proper is not on appeal. So for purposes of at summary judgment, this class can be treated in a unified whole. But Your Honor is exactly right. At that damages trial before a jury, one homeowner might stand up and say, yeah, my house is in the bottom left. That's where the state did its surface mining. Now there's pulverized gypsum under it. And the jury can try and determine what damages are caused by that. Another homeowner might be in the top above the mine that the state blasted open and that's now collapsing. That homeowner would have to explain to the jury his or her damages. And a third homeowner might be kind of not exactly on top of either of those. But as we alleged in the complaint, and as the state conceded, there's pulverized gypsum everywhere we say there is. So ultimately, a jury may have to parse some of the subjacent versus adjacent support questions. But the damages ultimately are traceable, as our expert noted, right back to the state's activity in the past and today.
Counsel, can you address 15-3-1? Is this a statute of limitations or repose, and are your claims time barred?
It's a statute of limitations, Your Honor. This court has referred to it as a statute of limitations in the past, and it's a 20-year statute. So at the earliest, we would be looking at damage occurring in the 2010s or maybe late in the 2000s. In any event, this complaint was filed well within that 20 years, and so it doesn't apply here.
One last question. You've referenced the blasting of the mine open. There's evidence in the record that the state was blasting the mine shut, looking around for additional gypsum, and then blasted what was already an open mine. Can you summarize the facts in the record that you are referencing regarding blasting the mine open versus an open mine they blasted shut?
I was just rereading about this yesterday because I was concerned that the factual record is a little confusing on this. There was the main mine that we're talking about is kind of in the northeast corner if you look at some of the maps. That mine was sealed, and that mine was blasted open when the state admits that it was looking for gypsum. Now, maybe the state could characterize it as they were closing the mine, but it was already closed. And it's the state's activity that caused it to be open, and now that the support that was there no longer applies. One thing that's confusing in the record, and to address your question, Justice Kern, is that there were other places that, you know, maybe a surface level entrance to a different part of the mine, a different underground mine, that aren't as big as that one that's in the northeast corner. And there are stray references in the record to other garbage being in those mines or an old car being in those mines. Those are kind of separate and apart from the main mine that we're talking about in that northeast corner.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Learburg.
Thank you. We ask that the court reverse.
We'll be in recess for about 10 minutes.